I want to talk this evening about skepticism. That's at least what I've been assigned to talk about, and I do want to talk about it. So that's a good thing, isn't it? I want to set a context here by saying to you that we now live in a cultural milieu in which we are called to do our ministries and to engage in spiritual formation as disciples of Jesus Christ. As we seek to grow in our faith in Jesus Christ, and as we seek to invite others to join His kingdom and to grow in partnership with Him and receive the grace of God, we work and minister and engage in ministry and apologetics in a cultural context that is hostile to religious knowledge, if not to knowledge in general. The idea today is roughly that there is no such thing as at least non-scientific knowledge. To put the point a bit differently, we now live in a secularized culture where the authority centers of learning, that is, those who are the gatekeepers for what can be known and what can't be known, what can be funded to do research on, what can't be funded to do research on, what is an appropriate dissertation topic and what isn't. The gatekeepers of our culture in the universities are pretty much united on the claim that there is no such thing as religious or moral knowledge. Now, as you may know, postmodernism, which we'll say something about later, is basically the idea that there's no knowledge, period. But certainly in the secular culture that we live in, secularism first and foremost says that there's no religious and ethical knowledge. If there's knowledge at all, it would be what sort of knowledge, do you think? Scientific knowledge, that's right. So you will often get the idea that if you can test something scientifically, or perhaps verify it commonsensically with the five senses, then it can be an item of knowledge for some people, not everybody, but certainly, religious claims are matters of personal opinion. They may neither be true nor false, and even if they are true or false, certainly no one can know them or even have good reasons to believe one way or the other. So we're reduced at the end of the day to forms of rhetoric and personal appeals that substitute for rational argument. Now, it's important for you and for me, I think, to know something then about skepticism as an intellectual position in order for us to be more effective in our ministries. And that's what I'd like to do this evening, is to simply lay bare a little bit about skepticism and talk to you about how to respond to the skeptic. You should have a little chart here. Who doesn't have the little handout sheet here? Does everybody else? I'm not starting with the chart. I'm heading toward it. My goal is to make the chart intelligible to you by the end of our time. Now, skepticism has been around for some time as a philosophical position. It has never been dominant. There was a period after the death of Aristotle, 300 years before Christ, up until the time of Augustine in the late 300s, where there were a couple of schools of Greek skepticism that began to flourish. And skepticism of that sort was combated effectively by Christianity, which, by the way, overtook the discipline of philosophy in classic culture. And St. Augustine, or Augustine himself, wrote a very powerful argument against skepticism called Against the Academics, or Against the Academic Skeptics. And so the point I'm making is that skepticism as a philosophical position has been around a while. It's gone underground. It kind of crept back up in Descartes' day because of becoming reacquainted through the Crusades with certain pieces of literature in the Holy Land and certain branches of philosophy. But today we find skepticism running more rampant, I think, than at any other time. I believe it's largely due to illiteracy on the part of many, many people in American culture. What I'd like to do then is to just say, before I go into more academic or intellectual remarks, is to remind you that what we're dealing with here is something of profound ministerial importance. This is an intellectual issue, but it's not simply that. It's a matter of deep personal concern. Why is that? Because we almost never act contrary to our beliefs. We almost always act consistently with what we believe and the degree to which we believe something. If you actually come to take it that you can't have knowledge or good beliefs about something, then that will have a strong impact on your life. that will have an impact on your life. Now, what I'd like to do then is say something about types of skepticism. I'd like to talk a bit about some general remarks regarding skepticism. I'll give you two arguments for skepticism. There are others, but I'll give you two arguments for skepticism, and then I'll respond to it. So I want to begin by kinds of skepticism. I'll say a word about some general remarks about that. Then I'll give you some arguments for skepticism, and then I'll talk about responding to it. And we'll see what kind of time we have left after that's finished. The first type of skepticism I want to mention to you is called iterative skepticism, I-T-E-R-A-T-I-V-E. The word iterative means what? Over and over again, over and over again. And the iterative skeptic is someone who simply asks the question, how do you know? Over and over again. Now, you talk to someone and they say, well, how do you know such and such? And you give them an answer. And they say, well, how do you know that? And you say, well, because of thus and so. And then they say, well, but how do you know that? And you give them an answer to that, and this sort of thing keeps going. You ever had an experience with somebody like that? Oh, okay. Well, haven't we all? Now, the thing that I want you to recognize is that the iterative skeptic can simply be ignored and dismissed. And I want to tell you why. The iterative skeptic is not really a participant in the conversation. He's just taking pot shots at the participants. You follow me on that? The iterative skeptic is not offering his skepticism as a substantial position. Okay? He's merely asking questions, he or she. So the iterative skeptic is simply sitting around asking, sort of like in drone-like fashion, how do you know, how do you know? And until the skeptic presents something on behalf of what he believes, then I think the proper response is to say to the iterative skeptic or to simply ignore him. Now, let me talk to you about how to do this practically. Somebody keeps saying, how do you know, how do you know, how do you know? One thing I think you could say would be, well, you know, I've given you two or three reasons for this now, and you keep asking me the same question. Why should I think your question is at all interesting? Why should I take your question to be one that even is worthy of an answer? What makes your question an important one or an interesting question that ought to be taken seriously? Now, if the iterative skeptic doesn't answer that question, then the thing to say would be, well, until you can give me some reasons for thinking that I should take this question seriously, I would be a fool to take it seriously because I don't think it's a serious question. And until you can give me some reason for taking the question, how do you know, seriously, then I'm going to just dismiss the question. I'm willing to listen to you if you'll give me some reason for thinking your question is a serious question. Now, if the person gives you a reason for taking his question seriously, then what you can do is to say, how do you know? Now, this is just a matter of, this is a friendly matter here. I'm not saying you don't want to be a jerk about this. But as the point I'm trying to get at is, unless the skeptic can give at least some grounds for thinking that the skeptical stance should be taken seriously, then he's not really a participant. He's not really offering anything. He's not a part of the discussion. It's kind of like being in a marriage where you're trying to interact with somebody and all the other person does is just sit back and go like this. Never says anything. Or just, you know, snarls at everything you say. They're not a part of the conversation. And iterative skepticism is not really a position. It's not a position. It's merely a posture. And I think that's important to remember. It is a posture. It is a way of posturing oneself, but it is not a position. Now, there are other forms of skepticism, however, that have been offered as things that we should take seriously. And in fact, there have been arguments that have been given for these forms of skepticism. I want to talk about these in general categories. The first type is what I call differences in the depth of skepticism. Differences in the depth of skepticism. Now, by depth, I mean differences in how certain the skeptic is that skepticism is true. indeed in the time of Christ and in the period between Aristotle and Augustine, the two schools of Greek skepticism actually differed over the depth of skepticism they employed. Let us consider the skeptical thesis. Let's call the skeptical thesis thesis T. And let's let T be the thesis that no one knows anything. No one has knowledge. Right? And that's T. So the skeptic says T. No one has knowledge. Now the question becomes, do we know that T is true or not? Now, what is called unmitigated skepticism, I don't mean to just throw fancy terms out here, but that's the term that's used to refer to it. The unmitigated skeptic was the person who said that he knew that skepticism was true. He knew that we couldn't know anything. The mitigated skeptic was the person who said we can't know anything, and with regard to thesis T, whether or not we can know anything, I don't really claim to know it either. Okay, so that was a skeptic that suspended judgment about everything, including the skeptical thesis itself. Now, I think it's pretty clear what to do with the unmitigated skeptic who claims that you can know, you can't know anything. And this is, I believe, one of the things Augustine did, was to point out their own inconsistency, or in modern terms, to say that that form of skepticism is self-refuting. Now, do you know what a self... you've heard a little bit about self-refutation. Maybe I could just clarify what it is for something to be self-refuting, if this would be helpful to you. Statements are about a subject matter. The statement, all dogs are mammals, is about what subject matter? Dogs. The statement, Kansas City should have beaten the Broncos, is about a football team, the Kansas City Chiefs. That's a true proposition, by the way. Okay, but we can debate that later. I have some reasons for it, though, I tell you. Okay, a statement is about a subject matter. Now, sometimes a statement is about a subject matter, and the statement itself is a part of its own subject matter. For example, I could make the statement that all English sentences have been uttered since the year 1000 AD. I don't know if that's true or not. But that would be a statement about what? All English statements, including the statement itself. Now, if a statement is about a subject matter, and the statement itself is a part of its own subject matter, and if the statement makes itself false, it's self-refuting. So the statement... or proposition, or if you know a little bit more about that, whatever you take on that. But the statement, there are no English sentences longer than three words, is self-refuting, right? The statement, I can't utter a single word of English, is self-refuting. Now, obviously, the proposition that I know that no one can know anything is self-refuting. The weaker claim, where someone adopts the view that no one can know anything, and about the skeptical thesis itself, I really can't know it. I think what you can do is begin to generate an infinite regress. And I'm not really right now trying to talk about how to deal with the skeptic. I'm just giving you some initial considerations. But I actually had a conversation with the son of the head of the philosophy department at UC Riverside when I was doing my master's degree, who went on to do a PhD at Columbia University. And he was a skeptic, or at least purported to be one. And so we were walking to the library one day, and I began to ask him. I said, I've been told that you are a skeptic of some sort or another. Is that right? And he said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I am. And I said, well, I'm puzzled by this. I said, do you know that skepticism is true? And he was smart enough to say, no, I don't know that skepticism is true. I think it's true. But I wouldn't be willing to claim to know it's true. I said, okay, that's fair. Do you know that you think it's true? Well, and he was smart enough to say, no, I think that it's true. Well, do you know that you think it's true? Or do you just think you think it's true? And we were, this was getting long, and I said, it's a short day here, and we can't go forever on this. I said, look, if you don't even know that you think it's true, then I don't think that you're clear whether this is your position or not. And until you're clear that it's your position, then you shouldn't be advocating it. And once you do think that this is your position, then you'll at least know something. Now, this is not a trick. This is not meant to be a trick. The bottom line is this. You can't reasonably doubt anything unless you know something. You can't reasonably doubt anything unless you know something. And what I was trying to get him to see was that if his skepticism was going to be something that he claimed was something that we all ought to accept, he had to start by at least knowing something. Even if it was only the contents of his own consciousness, that would be at least something you'd have to know. Now, the differences in depth of skepticism is one way of dividing skeptics. There is another category that's called differences in breadth. I've talked about iterative skepticism. I've talked about positions that differ in the depth of skepticism. And now I want to talk about skeptical positions that differ as far as breadth is concerned. And there are what are called local and global skeptics. Local and global skeptics. A global skeptic is skeptical about everything. He or she claims that we don't have knowledge about any area of the intellectual life. I don't know your backgrounds. I don't know how many of you have had a little philosophy or not, but when I use the term knowledge, there's also a skepticism against what's called justified belief that isn't against knowledge. And if you're not familiar with the distinction, don't worry about that. I'm just going to keep talking about knowledge here, things that we claim to know. The global skeptic says that I'm skeptical, or we can't have knowledge about anything, and he could differ in his depth about that. But that's a breadth concept. He could be certain, he could claim to know we can't have knowledge about anything, or he could claim to be tentative about whether we can have knowledge of anything. A local skeptic is someone who limits his or her skepticism to one area of the intellectual life. So, for example, someone might claim that we can have knowledge in of the external world by way of our senses. I can know a podium here because I can see it. But I can't have knowledge when it comes to ethics. So there would be a case where someone would be a local skeptic. They would limit their skepticism to, say, ethical claims, but employ a skeptical, not employ a skeptical stance, say, with regard to sensory knowledge of the external world. Now, the trick for the local skeptic is to keep his or her skepticism from spilling out into other areas. Because the reasons that justify skepticism in a local area can quite easily spill over and infect the rest of his claims elsewhere. So these are some basic types of skepticism now. And let me just give you some arguments that have been advanced for skepticism. There are a number I could give, and what I'll do is I'll give these two, and then I'll stop and I'll open it up for questions to see if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment. But let me give you two arguments for skepticism that have been offered in the history of philosophy. And the first argument from skepticism is from the fact of error and fallibility. Error and fallibility. The idea here is that we have, in fact, been mistaken many times in things we thought we knew. For example, a person sees an oar that's in the water and it looks bent to him. And if he just went by his senses, he would say, this is a bent stick. Or railroad tracks look like appear to us by way of our senses as though they touch in the distance. So if we went just by our senses, we would say, here are two tracks that meet about a half mile down the road there. But of course, we've discovered that those claims were wrong, and we were in fact mistaken. The oar was not bent in the water. The tracks didn't meet. We went down, and it turned out that they kept going parallelly, and that sort of thing. Again, we have claimed to have moral knowledge, or people have claimed to have religious knowledge, and it's turned out later that we were mistaken. So the argument is, look, haven't you been mistaken when it comes to your claims before? How about your sensory claims? Well, yeah, I've been mistaken. How about claims from memory? Have you ever made any claims that were based on your memories where you were mistaken? Yeah, more so even as I approach, that 50 thing. Yeah, I have. Well, then, how do you know you're not mistaken now? Haven't you been mistaken before? How do you know you're not mistaken now? This is the skeptical argument from the fact of error. Now, this is not a good argument, and I think it should be clear why it's not a good argument. At least on the surface of it, a better argument. But what strikes you as wrong with this argument? Does anything come to you initially about what would be wrong with an argument of this sort? Yeah.
How can we ever be sure of anything?
Okay, but you see, that would be the conclusion the skeptic would want you to draw. So if you raise that would I think he'd say, yeah, you know, bless your heart. I'm not sure that would work. That's a good shot, though.
How does he know that he's been wrong again?
Well, I think that's a little bit closer to home. Because, you see, this argument is the argument from the fact of error. And the claim is made that we have, in fact, been mistaken. And so if you ask the skeptic, well, can you give me an example of where we've been mistaken? And he says such and such. Now notice carefully that when we know things, there are what we might call classes of things that we know. And they all kind of look alike. For example, we all have knowledge by our senses of the physical world. We've seen it, touched it, tasted it, smelled it, or heard it. Okay? We have another class of knowledge that comes by way of memory. That's a different kind of knowledge. We all have knowledge of what I call self-knowledge. And I'll talk before the end of the evening on kinds of knowledge that don't involve the senses. But we all know which body in the room is ours. And that's not on the basis of senses. It's not as though I came in and looked around and said, well, this one looks like mine. No. There are many thoughts going on in the room right now, aren't there? I hope. Okay. And you know of all the thoughts in the room which thoughts are yours, don't you? You know which set of thoughts in this room are your thoughts. But you don't know that by your senses. Okay? As a matter of fact, if you didn't know which senses were yours without using them, you would never be able to use them to know other things and know that it was your knowledge. Okay? How would I know that this podium was here by way of my senses if I were not able to identify which sense experiences were mine, you see? To say it differently, I can see a podium, but I cannot see my seeing of the podium. But my seeing of the podium is every bit as real as the podium. Okay? So, there are classes of knowledge, and guess what this argument from the fact of error does? It picks a member of a class of knowledge to discredit all the members of that class. Okay? So we take class of sensory knowledge. It will say, look, you claim that you saw that orb and it looked bent to you, didn't it? And later on you found out by your senses that it was straight. So here, in order to discredit all sensory knowledge because of mistakes in sensory knowledge, an appeal is made to another member of the class. You see what I'm getting at here? And so the problem is that in order to refute a class of claims to know on this argument, you have to actually appeal to another member of the very class you're seeking to discredit. Again, memory. Someone can say, didn't you remember something, but you turned out that your memory was mistaken? Yes. Well, how do we know our memories are mistaken if it isn't based on other memories that aren't mistaken? And so there we use a claim from the class of memory knowledge to discredit the whole class, which rests on the veridicality and our knowledge, and certainly even our knowledge of another member of the class. Now, there's another argument from error that's a little bit more important for ministry and for the intellectual life. And this one is one that, unfortunately, René Descartes, who hated skepticism, when he offered the cure that killed the patient, bless his heart. His way of trying to get rid of skepticism played into the skeptic's hands. And here was Descartes' argument for skepticism that he sought to refute. The argument is from the mere possibility of error. Just from the mere possibility of error. So the idea goes like this. Look, isn't it possible right now that you're dreaming? Or isn't it possible that there really is no external world outside of you, but you are having sense experiences right now, either by an evil demon producing them in you, or if you want, God's just having fun with you for a while here. But there really is no external world, and God's merely producing sensations of chairs and tables in your mind, but there are no chairs around you. Isn't that just possible? Isn't it possible that your senses right now are deluding you in some way? Now, note very carefully. The claim is not, isn't it likely, or isn't it plausible to think that your senses are deceiving you? The claim is, isn't it just possible that your senses are deceiving you? And I think the answer is, well, yeah, it's possible. Well, if it's possible that you're mistaken, how can you know you're not mistaken? Isn't it possible that you're wrong about God or you're wrong about such and such? Yeah, in most cases. Well, then how do you know you're not? So you see, this is an argument that seeks to generate enough doubt to remove our claim to know something from the mere possibility that we're wrong. The mere possibility. So let's back up now, and let's try to develop a response to this that not only will give us something to say to the skeptic, but that will shed light on the intellectual life. I want to begin. Roman numeral 1 was types of skepticism. I talked about iterative. I talked about differences in depth and then differences in breadth. I've given a couple of arguments for skepticism, one from the fact of error and the other from just the mere possibility of error. What I want to do now is I want to begin to develop a response by talking about Roman numeral 3, something called the problem of the criterion. The problem of the criterion. Suppose that I asked you to sort apples up here. I had a basket of apples, and I said, I want you to sort these, and I want you to put the good apples over here in that basket and the bad apples over there. How would you go about sorting those apples? What would you do? Say, go ahead. Okay, pick them up and look at them. What would you be looking for?
Blemishes.
Okay. So you would you put the ones with the blemishes in the bad barrel and the ones with, okay. Any other thoughts on that? So you might be willing to put an apple with maybe one blemish if it wasn't too bad in the good apple, but one would say some number or other in the, okay.
What about the color?
Talk to me about the color.
Well, let's say it's purple, like it's body.
Okay, so where would you put those?
Well, on the back.
Okay. All right, now let me ask you a different question. I want you to engage in the same task, but only now not sort apples. I'd like you to sort purples. And I want you to put the good purples. Well, you've got to sort them. I'm not even going to say purples are the kinds of things that could go in baskets, but I want you to sort purples. How are you going to get going here? You think we've got to start by defining a purple? To find a good purple. Show me the purple. Yeah, that's the way to start it. Actually, these are very different answers. He wants to be shown a purple, and other people want a definition of a purple. Gosh, even a definition of a good purple. Say it again. Well, okay. Okay. We've got a problem here with purples, don't we? See, the problem with apples wasn't as bad because we all sort of, we had some experience with apples and we sort of know what's a good and bad one, so we had something to get off the ground with. But if we're starting with stuff we can't get off the ground with, there's kind of a problem here. Now, the task of intellectual knowers, this is something William Alston calls taking the epistemic point of view. I don't know. I'm just using these terms here in case you're interested. Roderick Chisholm says that these are the two main duties of intellectual beings, as insofar as they know things. And the task of those of us, our duty as knowers, is to take all the beliefs that we have, and we all believe many, 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 many things, don't we? And at the end of our lives, or as we make progress, to sort the true beliefs from the false beliefs, to hold on to the true ones, and to get rid of the false ones. Okay? That is to take the epistemic point of view. That's to care about truth and falsity. These are the duties of the knower, to attain true beliefs and to get rid of false beliefs. You see the task. Now look, there, if only one of those was our task, it would be easy to follow. Suppose that our task was to just, before we died, be sure that we believed everything that was true that we could possibly believe. Because would you agree with me that there are far more true propositions out there than you'll ever be able to ponder in your lifetime? So we're all going to die missing a lot of truths that we could have believed if we'd have thought about it, right? Does that make sense to you? So, but if we wanted to increase our chances of having as many true beliefs as we could by the time we die, you just believe everything. Just believe everything you ever heard. How to do it. I guarantee you, if you believe everything you hear, if you could do such a thing, when you died, you would have fulfilled that epistemic duty better than anybody else, any other stance that you could have taken. Now, there's another approach that we could take, of course, and this would aid us in avoiding falsehoods, and this would be simply to disbelieve everything we've ever heard, right? That would be easy. And that would guarantee that we would accept a minimum number of false beliefs before we passed away. The problem is that we want to maximize our holdings of true beliefs while at the same time minimizing our holdings of false beliefs. And that's what we've got to do. Now, how do we go about doing this? How do we start with the whole set of things we believe, as we all admit many, some of them true, some false. We all have true and false beliefs. We all recognize that there are things that we could believe if we thought about them that are true, that are lying out there waiting for us to ponder them and accept them. Okay? How do we fulfill these tasks? Three answers to the question. How do we engage in our sorting problem? The first answer is called Methodism. Not to be confused with John Wesley's denomination, though I do suspect there are more than a number of Methodists that are Methodists in this regard today anyway, though not Wesley. A Methodist says, before I can know anything, I have to have a criterion that answers the question, how I know it. Before you can know anything, let's say any proposition P, before you can know any proposition P, that it's raining outside, that 2 and 2 is 4, that mercy is a virtue, whatever. Before you can know any proposition P, you have to actually know two other things. Okay? And here are the two other things you have to know. You have to know some criterion Q that tells you how you know that P is true, right? And then you'd have to know something R, namely that P satisfied your criterion Q. Say you know before you can know that P, there is an exit sign at the back of the room. I'm going to have a criterion. If something appears to my senses very clearly, then I can know that it's true. I have to have that criterion. And I'd also have to know that this sign and the way it appears to me satisfies my criterion. You see that? So on this view, before you can know anything, you have to be able to answer the question how it is you know it before you can know it. Now, Methodism, I hope you're sensing, is the wrong approach to the question. Obviously, one problem with it would be that if I have to have some criterion before I can know anything, I would have to then have a criterion for knowing my criterion. Because there have been debates about different criteria. Not everybody's agreed on what are the proper criteria for knowledge. And if I'm going to use some criterion Q to justify my knowledge that P, I'd have to have a criterion that would allow me to know my criterion was true, because criteria have been called into question, and there are many different criteria. Does that make sense to you at this point? Now, the difficulty then is that if you start by thinking you have to have criteria for knowledge that answers the question how you know before you can know anything, you'll end up in an infinite regress that won't end. It's called a vicious regress, and that is unacceptable. You won't be able to know anything on that regards. In fact, the skeptic will have you in deep trouble at that point. The skeptic is really the third position. I haven't mentioned the second one. I'll come back to it, because the skeptic is the third position. And the skeptic says, since the first two don't work, the best conclusion is we don't know anything. So the skeptic thinks that the first two positions, the Methodist position and the one I'm about to tell you, don't work. And the skeptic concludes that since the other two strategies don't allow us to sort the true beliefs from the false beliefs, we don't know which are true and false, and we don't have any knowledge. Now, what is the second position? This liberated me in my ministry. I want to tell you a story before I share it with you. I have time to do this. I'd studied philosophy, and I'd read a little book by Roderick Chisholm called The Problem of the Criterion, 1973, Marquette University Press. A little brief book, 70-some pages. And I'd read this, and it had meant a lot to me. I got my doctorate, and I was reading Discipleship Journal one day. And in Discipleship, it's a navigator journal on spiritual discipleship. In that book, in that journal, there was an article, and part of the article was recommending that disciples of Jesus Christ read the book The Problem of the Criterion by Roderick Chisholm. I was shocked, because you don't typically think of discipleship. People who are concerned about discipleship that get involved in reading philosophical works. But right in front of God and Delorne Sani and all the rest of them was this article in Discipleship Journal that was saying that people ought to grapple with the problem of the criterion if they're going to serve Jesus Christ. And I thought, what a country. This is exciting news. And that gave me hope that this concept of the problem of the criterion and the solution to it that I think is the most plausible could have a tremendous impact on people's personal lives. And boy, I tell you folks, as I'll show you later in my own witnessing and evangelistic and debating and dialoguing ministry, it's been tremendously useful. The second position, the third I'm giving you, but number two, is called particularism. Particularism. And the particularist says that we start as knowers, with particular examples of things we know, we start as knowers with particular examples of things that we know without needing to know how we know them. We start as knowers with particular examples of things that we know without having to know how we know them. Now, let me give you some examples. And what I'm going to do now is give you examples of things I know that come from many areas of knowledge. Okay? I know that there's a podium here in front of me. I know that. I know that I had coffee in my Disneyland mug for breakfast this morning. There's something I know by way of memory. Okay? I know that if P is taller than Q and Q is taller than R, that necessarily P is taller than R. Okay? I know that not only is 2 plus 2 4, but it's necessarily the case that 2 plus 2 is 4. It's impossible for 2 plus 2 not to be 4. Okay? That's something I know. I know that I am now thinking about the problem of skepticism. Right? And I know that I am now conscious and I'm having certain color sensations appearing to me. I know that torturing babies for fun is wrong. I know that. I know that it's wrong to torture little babies by sticking pins in their eyes for the sheer joy of hearing them howl and scream. That's an item of knowledge that I know. By the way, I also know that kindness and tenderheartedness and mercy are virtues, and being vicious, hateful, vengeful, greed-filled people filled with rage is a vice. Those are things I know. Now, I might not be able to tell you how it is I know them, but I do know them. Now, parenthesis. It's important that the things we know be explainable and be at home in our worldview, because if they're not, then our worldview can provide what are called defeaters or problems for our claims to know. And more about that later. But look what the particularist has done. The particularist has simply said, well, look, I might not know a lot about epistemology, and I might not be able to tell you how I know, but I do know, and he lists A, B, C, D, and E. And he selects, or she selects, clear cases of things that he or she knows. Now, the skeptic is going to say this. Look, you've begged the question. All you've done is assert that you know things. And now the skeptic asks this question. How do you know such and such and thus and so? What the skeptic wants to do is to force the particularist to become a Methodist. Because if the particularist bites on the question and becomes a Methodist, the skeptic can run him out of town. Seriously. It's the game's up, because he can keep asking how you know that. And it's not that he's now practicing an iterative form of skepticism. Now he is merely teasing out the implications intrinsic to the Methodist commitment. You see that? Because the Methodist says, if I can't know such and such without knowing thus and so, then all the skeptic is doing is playing that out. It's saying, given your view, let me just keep asking this. This is your problem, you know. So that's how that goes. Now, what is at stake here between the particularist and the skeptic are different understandings of the intellectual life and knowledge. And here is this chart that I want you to come to now, and I want to try to flesh this out in the time we have left. On the left, in the left-hand column, I've listed the issue that I'll talk about. I will then give you the skeptic's view of that issue, and I'll give you the particularist's view of the issue. The first question is called the burden of proof. This is the issue of whether knowledge has got to be proven before we can claim to have knowledge, or where the burden of proof is on the skeptic to show that we don't have knowledge in general. Who shoulders the burden of proof? Does the person who claims to know some things, in general, have a burden of proof to have to show how he knows it before he can know it? Or does the skeptic have a burden of proof to try to show that the things the particularist claims he knows are things he really doesn't know? Who has the burden of proof here? And the skeptic says it's the particularist. The skeptic says the particularist shoulders the burden of proof. The skeptic says, until you can tell us how you know something, you can't know anything. Now, certainly there are cases where, unless we can tell how we know things, we can't claim to know them. That's certainly true. But what we're talking about is that true throughout our lives? Is that true all throughout our intellectual lives? And the skeptic wants to say that the burden of proof is on the person who says that he knows this, that, or the other. The particularist says the burden of proof is on the skeptic. To put it, the particularist says, look, I know I had coffee for breakfast this morning. What would make you think I can't know it? Right? So now what's happened is the particularist shifts the burden of proof on to the skeptic. Now, so this doesn't just turn out to be a game here. Well, you got the burden of proof, you have the burden of proof here, and we just get a shouting match going. We have to try to unpack more of these categories so very different conceptions of the intellectual life emerge. The second issue is the nature of knowledge. For the skeptic, knowledge requires certainty. If you're going to know something, you've got to have certainty about it. And that was Descartes' fundamental mistake. Descartes said to know something, it must be impossible to doubt it. It must be impossible to be wrong about it. And knowledge requires certainty. So for the skeptic, you see, to know something, you have to be certain about it. So I'm not going to go over to the particulars right now. Let's go down the column. That means all the skeptic has to do is to say, well, you might be wrong. Now, what kind of might does the skeptic mean? Well, it's called a logical might. In other words, isn't it logically possible that you're mistaken? And if the skeptic can say, isn't it just logically possible that you're mistaken? And remember, by logically possible, I just mean there's no contradiction in asserting that I'm mistaken about this. Isn't it possible that you only think you remember having coffee for breakfast this morning, but you didn't have coffee for breakfast? Isn't that logically possible? And the skeptic thinks that that's all that he has to do, because knowledge requires certainty, and if he can raise the possibility of error, then you can't know with certainty, and so you don't have knowledge. Now, according to the skeptic, how are we supposed to deal with the skeptic? And to make sense out of this category, I have to compare refuting someone and rebutting them. If you refute someone, you show that they're wrong. If you refute someone, you show that their view is wrong. Okay? If you rebut someone, you don't have to show they're wrong. All you have to do is show they haven't shown they're right. Okay, let's say it again. If you refute somebody, you show they're wrong. That's kind of like in a trial. It's sort of like having to prove the defendant's guilty. Okay? If you rebut someone, you wouldn't have to show the defendant was guilty. You'd have to show that there was no good reason to think he's not guilty. Okay? So to refute someone, you show their view's wrong. If you rebut someone, all you do is show not that their view's wrong, but you show that they haven't shown their view's right. That you haven't given me any good reasons for thinking your view's right. Okay? It might be right if I rebutted you, suppose. Suppose you make a claim and I rebut you. Then I'd say, look, your view may be right, but golly day, you haven't given me any reason yet to believe it. So, I mean, come on. If I refuted you, I would have shown your view as false, okay? Now, the skeptic says, I've got to be refuted. Your task, before you can know anything, is to show I'm wrong. Now, you see how this would play out in evangelism if you really took this view? You would have to show, before you could claim to know that mercy was a virtue, let's say, you'd have to be certain about that. And if it's possible that you're mistaken, you wouldn't be able to know it. And what you'd have to do would be to show that the skeptic was wrong. Now, that's a tall order. The particularist takes this differently. And the particularist says that knowledge doesn't require certainty. There are many things we know, but we're not 100% certain about. But that doesn't mean we don't know them. Okay? By 100% certain, that means it's possible that I'm mistaken. All right? But there are many things we know. I know that there's a podium here, even though it's possible that I'm mistaken about it in the bare possibility sense. Now, when the particularist says, I might be mistaken, the particularist uses what's called an epistemic might. And that means there are good reasons for thinking that I'm mistaken. There are good reasons for thinking that I'm mistaken. So what the particularist says is, look, let me go one more step here, and then I'll give you a dialogue and try to illustrate it and make it clearer. The particularist says, I don't have to refute the skeptic, I have to rebut him. I don't have to show skepticism's false. All I have to do is show that the skeptic hasn't given me good reasons for thinking he's right. Okay, so here I say, I had coffee for breakfast this morning. And the skeptic says, well, you know, isn't it possible? Might you not be mistaken? Isn't that logically possible? And the particularist says, yes, it is logically possible. But it's not epistemically possible. In other words, while it's barely possible I'm mistaken, there aren't any good reasons for thinking I actually am mistaken. And until you can give me some grounds for thinking that I am mistaken about this, then I don't have to think that I am mistaken. And you haven't given me grounds for thinking that your skepticism is correct. You haven't given me grounds for thinking that I am mistaken in my claim to know that I had coffee for breakfast this morning. So a guy comes up to me after an evangelistic meeting and I try to give an argument for God's existence based upon morality. And I started by asserting some propositions that I claimed all people in their fair moments would know would be true. And I claimed that torturing babies for fun was wrong, and that kindness and mercy were virtues and that sort of thing, and not vices. And being revengeful, hate-filled people would be to be filled with vice. And the claim was that I was asked, well, gosh, how do you know those things? I mean, and I said, well, you know, why? Tell me why you think that this is a problem with knowing these things. Well, you know, we all make claims, don't we, that we could be mistaken about, right? And isn't it possible that you're wrong about this? In fact, I'd like to see how you could prove you're right. And I said, well, look, from the fact that I could be wrong about it, it doesn't follow that I am wrong about it. And in fact, I know this, and I believe you know it. I believe you know that torturing babies for fun is wrong. What would make you think we can't know it? Now, what I had done, now you've got to be careful with this, because you can't just wield this kind of thing in every question whatsoever. Now, remember, the questions like, did Jesus raise from the dead, or is abortion wrong, or things of that sort, may require more argument. Right now, what I'm just talking about is whether we can know anything at all. What I'm going to claim is that we go from clear things we know, and we develop criteria, and then we move to problem areas and build knowledge that way. But we start with clear cases. We reflect on them and learn, and then we extend knowledge by developing criteria into new areas. But if we can't start with things we know, we will never be able to develop criteria to judge things we're puzzled about. That's where I'm headed with this. Now, of the two tasks of epistemology, the skeptic emphasizes avoiding false beliefs. The skeptic says, look, I don't want to have any false beliefs that I believe, and I'd rather avoid false beliefs than have true beliefs. The particularist cares more for truth than avoiding error. It's kind of like the theist who cares more, who believes that God, and Bill Craig, I think, has argued this in a different way, so this is not a direct quote, but that God is more concerned about getting people to heaven than he is about keeping people out of hell. Otherwise, hell has veto power on heaven, C.S. Lewis put it. The particularist says, I'd rather have truth, even if that means I'll have a few false beliefs. The skeptic would rather have no false beliefs, even if that means missing the truth. You see the difference there? May I say something to you very important about this? Your life can be harmed every bit as much by failing to believe something that's true as it can by believing something that's false. And I think that needs to be said, because there's an attitude today that there is sort of a general presumption towards skepticism, and if you're an enlightened, intelligent person, you'll take a skeptical stance on things. There's this sort of this general... You know, I've never heard anything even approximating a good argument for that stance. Now, maybe, you know, UFOs, okay, I think you ought to start with... There are certain areas, but guess what? When we start with skeptical positions about certain areas of life, that's usually based on other things we already know, right? And we feel like we're in a pretty good cognitive situation with regard to UFOs or things like that, so we have a right to be skeptical. But that is a long way down. That's an expression of a whole bunch of things we already are taking ourselves to know, you see. But in terms of the general idea that you're actually a wiser or better person to somehow doubt things as opposed to believe things, and that we ought to care more about avoiding error than having truth. Look, you can get hurt every bit as badly by refusing to believe that something that's true that is true than by believing something that's false. And that is very important to keep in mind. Now, the particularist talks about the right to be sure about something. He says, look, we have a right to be sure about the things we know. I have a right to be sure that I had coffee for breakfast this morning. I have a right to be sure that mercy is a virtue. Now, when the skeptic hears that, the particularists say, look, I know I had coffee for breakfast this morning, or that mercy is a virtue, and I have a right to be sure about that. The skeptic hears that by saying, I'm going to be dogmatic in the sense that I am closed to the issue. I'm not willing to read anything more about it. I'm not willing to listen to any further arguments against my view. I'm closing conversation. And so the skeptic says that particularism, because the particularist claims to be sure, not in the sense of 100% certain, but claims to know some things, well, that closes conversation. That closes the conversation. Now, so what we have at the end of the day then is that the particularist starts by things that we know, and he believes that we do not have to prove that we can know things before we can know them, and he asks the skeptic to try to tell him why he thinks we've got to know how we know before we can know anything at all. He has a very different picture of knowledge that is generated here. Now, what can be said in favor of particularism is that particularism is a better account of knowledge that harmonizes with the fact that we really do know many things. Roderick Chisholm says at the end of his article, one thing in favor of particularism is that it does allow us to claim what we already knew we could claim, namely that we know many things after all. To say it differently, before you ever came to this class, you knew many things, didn't you? And the particularist account is an account of knowledge that makes sense out of the fact that you know many things. If the skeptical account of knowledge is accepted, then it turns out that you and I know either nothing or precious little. And skepticism, then, is an inadequate account of knowledge because it does not account for the things that we know independently of our discussion of skepticism. Now, the skeptic can say, well, that is itself question begging. And then you can have the conversation all over again. So what I want to suggest is then that you don't need to say how you can know things in general before you can know anything. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't places where argument and evidence are important before you can know things. And being able to spell out evidence isn't important before you can know things. But I'm suggesting that in general, we don't start as knowers by having to answer how we know things. We start with individual things we know, and we build up to develop criteria of weighing evidence and that sort of thing, and we extend our knowledge. Now, I want to suggest a couple of other things before we close here. And I want to say something about things that we know apart from the use of the senses. Things that we know apart from using our five senses. It's important for you to have examples of things that we know that we don't know by seeing, touching, tasting, smelling, or hearing them. So let me just list some examples. First of all, self-knowledge. We know our own thoughts and feelings. We know our own sensations. But we don't know our own thoughts and feelings by seeing them, touching them, tasting them, smelling them, or hearing them. You follow me on that? I know which eye in the room is my eye, if I can put it to you that way. I know which ego. When I use the first person pronoun I in the standard sense, I know which it refers to. And I know who's using it to refer, more fundamentally, without having to see, touch, taste, smell, or anything. I also think our knowledge of our own body is that way, as I suggested a while ago. I don't think that our knowledge of which body is mine is based upon sensations. Because it would be impossible for me to know which body was mine if I had to do that on the basis of a sensation, because I wouldn't be able to identify the relevant body to judge is mine, if I didn't already start by knowing which body was mine. That probably wasn't real helpful. Our knowledge of other minds, my knowledge that you're conscious, is not something that is at least totally based on... There's a key element of my knowledge that there are other conscious beings that goes beyond what I can simply see and touch and taste and smell and hear. My knowledge of mathematics and logic can't be based upon what we can see. Think about this. We know that 2 and 2 is 4. But we don't just know 2 and 2 is 4, as I said earlier. We know it's necessarily 4. You understand that? It's not even possible that 2 and 2 be 5 or not be 4. So it's not only that we know 2 and 2 is 4, but we know what is called the modality or the degree of strength or the impossibility of the proposition. And this is not something we know by on the basis of a sense experience. I don't justify my knowledge that 2 and 2 is 4 by appealing to something I can see, touch, taste, smell, or hear as the basis for mathematical knowledge. I can't go into that now, but let me just tell you that at SC, one of my professors, Hartree Field, denied that 2 and 2 was 4 in his writings and in class because he did not want to have to believe in things that were not physical, namely numbers, and things that we could know that weren't numbers. You follow me? If 2 and 2 is 4, probably that statement is about what are called invisible mathematical objects that you can't see, touch, taste, smell, or hear. I have a bumper sticker on a thing that says I break for abstract objects or universals, and it's sort of a funny deal. Okay, it's supposed to be funny. I was in a filling station, and I was getting gas out, only in Southern California, and I had I break for universals, and the guy pulls up to get gas next to me. He says, "Hey, I break for universals. What's that?" And I said, "Well, it's a long story." And he said, "Well, you know, what is it? I'd like to know." And so I said, "Well, it's you can't see universal things that are kind of outside space, and you can't see. So you couldn't break for them. So the claim you could break for them is supposed to be kind of a joke." And he said, "Oh," he said, "I thought it was some sort of a homosexual deal or something, you know, some kind of a sexual thing here." And I thought, "Golly, no way! You know, I'm universalism. Where's my bumper? I get that thing off my car. I mean, what is this? You know, it's a philosopher's joke that went badly sour." There are examples of, I believe, religious experience that we can know that aren't based on sense experience and so on. Now, these are just examples of things that we know without the knowledge being coming primarily by appeal to sense experiences to know them. So the claim that we can only know what we can see, touch, taste, smell, or hear, I'd argue that moral knowledge also does not involve, in an essential way, sense experience. So those who claim you can only know things by seeing, touching, tasting, smelling, or hearing them are going to have trouble with all these kinds of knowledge that I just appealed to. These are examples of knowledge that go beyond what we can know. Now, let me say something very important. I heard Bill talk a little bit about the moral argument here. About meaning in life. And I think he was, if I didn't misunderstand him, I think he was trying to claim something like, if, as a matter of fact, the existential dilemma we face is that if there is no God, then there's no purpose or value or meaning to what we do and to us. And the only possibility for there being purpose and meaning and that sort of thing is that there be a God. And I think that's correct. I'm very much in favor of that argument. Suppose, though, an unbeliever claimed to know that mercy was a virtue, or suppose an unbeliever claimed to know that it was wrong to torture innocent babies for fun. Now, you see, I think that that person would be right, not only that that's true, but would be right, at least initially, to claim to know that. But now suppose the person were an atheist, right? Now what's happened is that the atheism raises a defeater. A defeater is something that counts against a claim. Now the atheist has got a defeater for what he claims to know that now counts against the claim. Illustration. I claim to be able to see that there is some water on the road, and I'm going to have to put my brakes down, push them down here pretty soon because the road's wet. Somebody says to me, well, you recognize now, don't you, that you're driving in the desert, that it's 105 degrees outside, it hasn't rained around here for 5 months. Okay. Now what I've got is a defeater. Okay. And what I took myself to know, and under other, and without a good skeptical argument against me, notice now the skeptic's given me an argument against my view, but without a skeptical argument, I may have been within my rights to have claimed to know that there's water on the road. But now I've got grounds for thinking that that's a mirage. I've got a defeater to my view. Do you follow me on that? Now, suppose the skeptic starts off by saying it's wrong to torture babies for fun. Fair enough. But now we've got a problem to raise against him, and that problem is very much like pointing out to him, well, look, you're in the desert. It hasn't rained for 6 months. In other words, we can cite conditions that make the claim that this is a moral truth extremely hard to justify. Very much like we can cite conditions when a person says there's water on the road, it's hot, it's a desert, blah, 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 that make that claim now hard to sustain and justify. So what happens is that atheism now becomes a tremendous defeater against the claim that we can't have moral knowledge and that there are moral truths. And now the atheist becomes unjustified, given his atheism, in continuing to assert that there are moral propositions. So something has got to go. Either the atheism, which is defeating his claims to know, or he's got to admit that he doesn't have moral knowledge after all, and that things are, as far as he can tell, relative. You see that? Now, let me say something a little differently about evolution. I actually think that evolutionary naturalism, and this is an argument that was developed by C.S. Lewis in a book called Miracles, and it was it's been developed recently by Alvin Plantinga in a slightly different way in his book, Warrant and Proper Function. And I'll develop it in the detail he does, but basically the idea goes like this. If there's no God, in evolution is how we got here. Now, stay with me for 15 minutes. I know you're tired, and this is sort of like taking a drink out of a fire hydrant. I understand that. Believe me, I get sick of hearing myself talk every bit as much as you do. But stay with me for 15 minutes. How would you like to be in my shoe? I've got to go home with myself. So, I mean, I've got to stay with myself, gosh, for a long time. And so, anyway, but you only have to do it for 15 minutes. Okay, so stay with me. You know that evolution is a story about how living things developed, right? But not only is it a story about how frogs came about and how dogs came about, it's a story about how all their parts came about, isn't it? It's a story about how the frog leg came to be the way it is, right? It's a story about how the turtle's shell came to be the way it is. And it's a story about how all organisms and all of their parts and all of the processes that go on inside of them came about. And the answer that evolution gives is, naturalistic evolution, is that everything that you see in the living world and all of its parts and faculties and processes came about for four purposes. To aid the organism in feeding, fighting, fleeing, and reproducing. Okay? In aiding the organism, essentially, in getting its body in the right place at the right time. In feeding, fighting, fleeing, and reproducing. And if a body part or a faculty or a process inside of an organism hindered it, or at least you hindered it certainly, or might not have helped in feeding, fighting, fleeing, and reproducing, then that part would have been eventually weeded out. So at least the part can't hinder. If it's neutral, it could get passed on, but certainly can't hinder, or it eventually gets weeded out. Now, here's what that means. All of your faculties, including your sensory, your ability to see, smell, touch, taste, and hear, and think, if that's brain processes or whatever at this point, all of those processes are what they are, and to enable you to win in the struggle for survival. Here is the key thing to remember. As far as evolution is concerned, you are a black box. What's a black box, you engineers? What's a black box? Okay, but give me a general. What is a black box in general? So my briefcase is a black box. But what's precious. A black box is something that you don't know what's going on inside of it, and you don't care what's inside. You don't care about the stuff inside the machine or whatever it is. All you care about is if you put the right things into the machine, you get the right things. My computer is a black box as far as I'm concerned. There quite literally could be a mouse inside the thing that just is real smart. I don't know. All I know is you give certain inputs in it, and it belches stuff out on the screen. And occasionally on the printer. Okay, now the point about a treating something as a black box is that the insides are invisible to you. You don't care. The only thing that becomes noticeable is if you put inputs in it, you get the right outputs. Now, as far as evolution is concerned, organisms are black boxes. That is to say, the struggle for survival, I'm speaking metaphorically, but doesn't give a rip about what's inside frogs or dogs or ducks, right? The only thing evolution cares about is when the input comes in, the rabbit surveys the hillside and it gets an input. You know, there's a wolf or a fox or coyote out there and certain inputs come inside. Whatever happens inside that rabbit, as long as it gets that rabbit in the right place at the right time, that's all that matters for evolution. It doesn't matter what goes on inside to get the rabbit out of there. You with me? So as far as evolution is concerned, the rabbit could survey the hillside. There's a coyote here. The rabbit could have an appearance. Suppose it's a female rabbit. The coyote appears like a handsome male rabbit to it. And this produces a desire in the rabbit to be close to the male rabbit, and to satisfy that desire, the rabbit runs 100 degrees in the opposite direction and hides in a cave. Evolution would select for that. Rabbits who behaved that way would survive and pass those on. That means that every time rabbits who looked out at coyotes and saw male or rabbits of the opposite sex developed a desire to be attracted to that rabbit, and that desire caused the rabbit's legs to run in the opposite direction and get away, would pass those internal processors on to its offspring, and evolution could give a rip. Okay? The key thing is, evolution doesn't care if a rabbit senses the world accurately or has the correct, if you want to attribute beliefs and desires to them, whatever, it doesn't matter. As long as it gets in the right place at the right time, that's all evolution cares about. I think Planning uses an example of something like this. The guy talks about a human being. Suppose there was a person, I'll just use the word Ed, who has this habit when he's in the jungle, when he sees a tiger, the tiger does look like a tiger to him this time, but whenever a tiger appears to him, he forms the belief that the tiger loves him and wants to play with him. And he has a desire to play with a tiger, and he satisfies that desire by running and hiding from the tiger. Now, you see, that kind of process would guarantee survival and would be passed on. The important thing to see is that having sensory faculties that accurately perceive the external world and having processes that think and believe accurately about the external world is not particularly survival enhancing. As long as the frogs saw the bad guy, you suppose that the big things hurt frogs and little things were good for frogs. As long as the frog was consistently deceived, saw the big things as little and the little things as big, it could get in the right place at the right time and do fine. Now we got a problem, don't we? Because the evolutionary naturalist claims that he has reasons to believe, and in fact today, that he has knowledge that evolutionary theory is true. Problem is now that evolutionary theory, if it's true, implies that our faculties are not truth-gathering faculties from the world in which we live. This means that I now have serious grounds to not trust my own intellect and senses, in which case I can no longer have grounds for trusting that evolutionary naturalism is true. Thus, evolutionary naturalism provides a defeater against the claim to have knowledge, just like atheism provides a defeater to claim that there are objective moral truths, and not only that, but that we can know them. And so there is a skeptical problem that is intrinsic to evolutionary naturalism as a worldview that presents a defeater.